And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's October 3rd, and that is the Cock of the North. Going out to all you Gordon Highlanders on the border north of my mother's family, the Sept of the Clan Buchanan, the Macuat family, and the pipes, of course, are a way to gather people. And we gather people every week on the show to not only learn about the problems, but craft solutions to train you about how to take back your sovereignty, your common law rights, and build a Republic of Kanata here and wherever in the world people are fighting for their sovereignty in the face of corporate tyranny. Murderbydecree.com, republicofkanata.ca. And I can't resist. I've got to start with, as well, this poem. It reminded me listening to the pipes of childhood memories in Winnipeg when I was at my mom's family's place every Sunday night for roast beef dinner. And some of my older uncles would get drunk. And Uncle Earl, who had fought in World War II as a young boy, he would get up on the table and get all drunk and drink whiskey, and he'd recite this poem, which I had drilled into my mind at a young age. Scots who with Wallace bled, Scots whom the Bruce has often led, welcome to your gory bed or to victory. And of course, one of the American versions of that is live free or die. I think that's still the motto of the state of New Hampshire. Live free or die, there's no gray area, folks. We either have our liberty or we're walking dead. And we're learning that more and more. Last week's show, I really hope you listened to it. It was the description of the 11,657 votes that were garnered by our Republic of Kanata in the last fraudulent election on September 20th. And discussing with Suzanne Holland of the Chilcotin Indigenous Nation, the treaty being signed between our new republic and her and other Indigenous nations, how we build that alliance on the ground to take back the nation for everyone. And as part of that, I really have to remind you folks about the eviction and banishment order that came out July 1st, issued by the 9 different Indigenous nations in Kanata against the Roman Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches, invoking the Great Spirit and the land law tradition of our nations by evicting and banishing forever these genocidal churches that killed more than 60,000 children in their so-called Indian residential schools and got away with it. Nobody ever went to jail for that. And they're even holding their now farcical National Day of Reconciliation on September 30th, whereby the mass murderers get to define how we remember their little victims. Well, getting off the hook about it. Well, they're not off the hook because they're ordered off our land. Their property and assets are forfeited. Their officers can be arrested on site. The Catholic, Anglican, United Churches found guilty as far back as February 2013, the verdict of the International Common Law Court of Justice. To get a copy of that eviction and banishment order, go to murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. Go to the July 1st posting. There'll be a PDF there of the eviction and banishment order. Not only place it on those churches, but go in and reclaim those churches as common ground, open it as a daycare center, or a place for the homeless, however you want to reclaim that territory, especially on Indigenous territories. So one of the things we're going to do today is we're going to look into how that came about. How is it that genocide in one country or in a whole culture can be so normalized that it can be looked at and act as if it wasn't really genocide? This is the thing that has really perplexed me for over 25 years, because it struck home against me in my own life. How do people commit this crime and then live alongside it as if, you know, nothing really happened? We're going to look at that today, but also what led up to this. Really, people are acting, you know, concerning these COVID measures, the COVID police state, as if it's something new and horrible. Well, yeah, of course it's horrible, but it's nothing new, folks. It's exactly what has been going on against all sorts of targeted groups right in our own midst for a hell of a long time. And in that regard, I want to thank everyone, actually, who's been writing in recently, because it's a hard time we're going through now and we need each other. And I've been getting a number of very beautiful emails from people thanking me for all the work that I've been doing. And one of these folks who wrote in said, Kevin, be brave enough on the air to just tell us how you're doing. And all right, I'm picking up the challenge. Although I tried to write down some words earlier and I realized despite my ability in writing, it's coming hard to me to put into words exactly where I'm at after so long such a long struggle and so much loss, and yet so much gain. But I did find an interesting quote from a book. It's a biography of Niccolo Machiavelli, actually. And I just, these couple of paragraphs kind of describe where I'm at these days. And it reads, "There are times when fortune inflicts wounds that simply won't heal, when the story of a life breaks into two distinct sections, a before and an after. Those who experience this sort of break discover that from a certain day on, they are no longer the same person. They suffer an anguish they have never felt before. They discover personal resources and strength they didn't know they existed. And they see the world and their fellow humans in a new and a chilling light. They may find that they're stronger. They may find that they're more vulnerable. In any case, they find that they are different and they're misunderstood. Tremendous grief is like a wind that sweeps away small things, leaving the soul capable of perceiving only the great, unless that wind withers up completely the very roots of life. Afterward, some still manage to smile, even though they have lost everything they held dear. But it is a smile of determination and challenge. It dies on the lips without warming the soul, without loosing the grief that clamps tight to the heart." I'd say that's pretty accurate concerning my feelings these days. But here's my answer to it. And I always go back to my friend Walt Whitman, that beautiful man who, one of the great poets of America, who wrote during the American Civil War, that slave owners' rebellion to try to destroy the Republic that failed. And Walt wrote a beautiful poem once. It's called "To a Foiled Revolutionary." And it goes like this, and it speaks right to my heart. And here's where I'm at as well. "Courage yet, my brother, my sister. Keep on, for liberty is to be served whatever occurs. There is nothing that is quelled by one or two failures, or any number of failures, or by the indifference or ingratitude of the people, or by any unfaithfulness, or the show of power, soldiers, cannon, penal statutes. What we believe in waits latent forever through all the continents, invites no one, promises nothing, sits in calmness and light, is positive and composed, knows no discouragement, waiting patiently, waiting its time. Not songs of loyalty alone are these, but songs of insurrection also, for I am the sworn poet of every dauntless rebel the world over. And he going with me leaves peace and routine behind him and stakes his life to be lost at any moment. The battle rages with many a loud alarm and frequent advance and retreat. The tyrant triumphs, or supposes he triumphs. The prison, scaffold, garret, handcuffs, iron necklace, and lead balls do their work. The named and the unnamed heroes pass on to other worlds. The great speakers and writers are exiled. They lie sick in distant lands. The cause is asleep. The strongest throats are choked with their own blood. The young men droop their eyelashes toward the ground when they meet. But for all this, liberty has not gone out of the place, nor the tyrant entered into full possession. When liberty goes out of a place, it is not the first to go, nor the second or third. It waits for all the rest to go. It is the last to leave. When there are no more memories of heroes and martyrs, and when all life and all the souls of men and women are discharged from anywhere on earth, then only shall liberty or the idea of liberty be discharged from that part of the earth and the tyrant come into full possession. So courage, revolter and revoltress, for till all ceases, neither must you cease. I do not know what you are for. I do not know what I am for myself, nor what anything is for. But I will search carefully for it, even in being foiled, in defeat, poverty, misconception, imprisonment, for these two are great. Did we think only victory is great? So it is. But now it seems to me, when it cannot be helped, that defeat is great, and that death and dismay are great." Thank you, Walt. Because my death, my dismay have been great because they've led me on to great things, to leading a great movement, and to be here with all of you today. So we have to look for that shadow in the light and light in the shadow all the time, folks. And that's, once again, the theme of today's show. At the midpoint, I'm going to do or play one of my sermons I do for the Covenanters, that movement, spiritual reclamation movement, of which I'm a minister. And after that, I'm going to do reading actually out of my Murder by Decree book, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, which was written as a way to counter the lies of the government and church-run spin called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where evidence was not allowed to be entered if it involved the death of a child or a mass grave. And this spin operation they're doing now about these selected graves that whose remains they're destroying while pretending to investigate, all of this is in response to the fact that we put that evidence out over many years. And I'm going to look specifically in the latter part of the show today about how does the denial of genocide occur in our culture? How has it happened? And how does genocide get so normalized that when you do it to one group like Native people, you can then turn it around and do it to all of us, like is happening now? So I'm going to get into that. But before that, before in the next 10 minutes or so, I want to, again, touch on this whole theme of how the COVID corporate police state is a continuation of tendencies that have been around for a number of decades. It's not a new invention. And this is what I get frustrated with when I'm looking at all the commentators about, you know, the COVID measures and the way to resist and all the different attitudes, wherever you stand on the whole issue of, you know, inoculations or whatever, people are missing the main point is that this is nothing new. It's a manifestation of something that started decades ago, something we call the corporatocracy, and it really manifested in a big way in the 1990s after the era in the 1980s where the world economy was kind of reoriented. They called it privatization, but it was a huge power grab by multinational corporations to basically take over society. And they succeeded for now. But for the last 30 years, they've been fashioning this corporate police state. And it's very important to look at that. In one of the sections of my latest book, it's called Memoirs of a Revolutionary. You can get it at Amazon, that pig dog corporation. Memoirs of a Revolutionary, on part two, it's called A Systemic Psychosis, the Nature of the COVID Corporate Police State. And let me just read a little bit of this. Mass murder by the state is never personal. It's simply business as usual. Genocide is a modern growth industry, whether killing off Aboriginals or enslaving and vaccinating the world's population under the guise of a public health emergency, it operates according to the norms of corporate efficiency. One of the best chroniclers of the Hitlerian prototype of the present corporatocracy was William Schreier, who observed in a book called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich that the Nazi state, which is really the forerunner to what we have now, the permanent arms economy and the permanent corporate state, the Nazi state had to shed its more brutal aspects to consolidate itself and to put into effect what it called its final solution of the so-called inferior people, the Untermenschen. The random violence of SA thugs and street gangs had to be curtailed to create the death camps under the control of the SS. In fact, individual acts of random murder and brutality by SS guards was discouraged in the camps and punished because, according to the words of SS leader Adolf Eichmann, quote, these actions detract from our sacred mission to cleanse our society of its diseased elements as quickly and efficiently as possible. Well, today the diseased elements are considered the people who don't get the shot, right? Now, in truth, the Nazi death camps were not simply mindless, pointless savagery, but they were a new kind of society of total domination, which laid the basis for the modern COVID corporate police state. There's a good book about that by Jim Mars, M-A-R-R-S, called The Fourth Reich, in which he described how after the war, the whole Nazi ideology and corporate system came over and implanted itself in the United States. First through the CIA, the MKUltra mind control programs, and then generally to what we have now. So let's apply this understanding for a minute by examining the COVID state as a system of total domination that, like Nazism and every genocide in history, seeks to cleanse society of its so-called diseased elements. We have to include in our study an even more relevant example of that kind of bureaucratic tyranny, the systematic extermination of enslaved Aboriginal children in the Christian death camps of Canada that are falsely still called Indian residential school, because that system led directly to the COVID police state based on the same measure of rule by decree through orders in council. Orders in council in Canada created the COVID police state, the Indian Act, the residential schools. That's the system in Canada. Nobody thinks of democracy. One bureaucrat tells you to take a shot or distance, and everybody does it. It's a system of rule by decree that's been around from the beginning of Canada. Now, some of the more notorious orders in council that ensured the extermination of Indigenous children in these death camps were embodied in a threefold punch that happened between 1910 and 20. During those years, the Privy Council in London and Ottawa issued orders that, like the COVID measures, were never approved by Parliament or the courts. These Privy Council orders, first of all, made it mandatory for children to be quarantined in residential schools and hospitals on pain of imprisonment. Sound familiar? Abolished all medical inspection in these schools, despite an enormous death rate of over 50%, and stripped Indians of the right to sue, to vote, to hire a lawyer, or to petition the government. These explicitly genocidal measures followed from these restrictions. So in other words, the restrictions were not brought in any more than they are now as an end in themselves, but to prepare for the general genocide that followed, including involuntary sexual sterilization, medical experimentation, and the vaccination of any Indian, which has been the law in Canada since 1874. You cannot refuse vaccinations if you live on Indian reservations. We heard an example of that last week from a report from Martin Ducharme in Manitoba, whose child is now being taken out of her home, taken from her parents, so that they can be put in the home of a vaccinated family. That's the rule in Canada on the Indian reservation. Same laws now being applied to everybody. Now, these genocidal measures were executive orders of state. They were not ever approved legally or democratically, any more than the COVID measures are being now. Now, what I find remarkable is that Canadians today refuse to make the connection between these criminal actions towards Indians over the last 150 years and the present police state measures by the same genocidal government which committed these crimes with the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches. They're justifying it now as then by reasons of public health. The residential schools originally justified, and you can look at newspaper articles at the time, proof of that in murderbydecree.com. These schools were justified as a public health measure, saying we had to protect ourselves from these dirty Indians who bore TB, when in fact, we introduced TB among them. Genocide is introduced by governments, by armies, or churches, always using public safety or sanitation rhetoric. This fact not only ensures public acquiescence with the crime, but camouflages the murderous intent. So when you look at what happened in natives in Canada and are now happening to everybody in this country and around the world, it's a process of increasing enslavement to justify eventual extermination. The targeted populations legally disenfranchised, they're made stateless persons. They're forced to obey orders that don't come out of courts or parliaments or legislatures, but are acts of decree. People are then expected to police themselves and regulate their own servitude and imprisonment, and eventually line up for the cattle cars and exterminate themselves. Well, you know, this is the same pattern playing itself out. And we have an example of the tragic effect of that in this farcical thing that happened on September 30th. The genocidal actors in this crime have announced a national day of remembrance for their victims. They're saying only 215 died, not 60,000. It's yet another incredible brainwashing and whitewashing going on. And that's why on that date, we held seminars all over the continent in which we're telling the real story and saying it's time to boot these genocidal actors off our lands, not just the churches, but their allies. For example, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, all the big pharmaceutical companies perfected the COVID drug and these other drugs by killing off a lot of experimental test subjects, i.e. native children in Indian hospitals and residential schools. Yet these mass murderers, you're going to allow to stick a needle into your arm or your child's arm. Well, that's just suicide or insanity. And so we see how it blows back on all of us. Now, I'm going to play now a sermon I did a couple of years ago, just as we're going into Advent in December. And it's taken from the passage that they traditionally read in church at Christmas, the massacre of the children ordered by King Herod. When he heard the rumor that Jesus was being born, he ordered all the kids killed. So that, I think, is very relevant to what we're talking about. We're going to listen to that. And after that, we'll be back talking about how genocide gets normalized.
Hi, everyone. Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice again. This is my sermon for the fourth Sunday in Advent, December 22nd. It's entitled Slaughtering Children, Business as Usual in the Palace. This is about the slaughtering of the innocent by King Herod. And when the wise men had left, look, a heavenly messenger came to Joseph and cried, "Wake up, take the baby Jesus and mother and flee to sanctuary and live there until I bring word, for King Herod will seek to destroy the baby." Then Herod set out in his wrath to exterminate all of the helpless innocents in Bethlehem and its region who were 2 years old and younger, relying on the knowledge of the wise men. And from every hilltop came the call to mourn and to weep inconsolably, for the mothers of the dead cannot be comforted. Well, their tiny butchered remains lie under your feet. They were happy, innocent children, and they were slaughtered and thrown into secret graves. Just think about it. Try to imagine that. Try to picture it and feel their suffering. Well, can you? Will you dare to? Because they died at the hands of church and state. These were official killings. And so you're not just supposed to ask about what happened to those children. You're not supposed to even know or care what happened, or even imagine the experience of it happening. You're not even allowed to cry out in horror and outrage and call for the horror to stop. Your heart is to remain distant and numb, just as the victims are to remain silent and forgotten, to remain invisible, because the killers are still in charge. The killers of those children are still running the governments and the churches and the businesses. And if you mention the fate of those babies and ask who is to blame and why it happened, the killers will strike at you. So do the smart thing. Stay quiet. Think of nice, positive things. Pay your taxes that allow the crimes to continue. And don't imagine those mass graves of children or the horrible screams of babies being chopped to pieces. Sacrifice your soul as their little bodies were sacrificed, all for the service of the emperor. You can do something else instead. It's risky, but it's possible. You can do what your soul and those victims require. You can risk everything in your life for the sake of the lost children and for all the others who will die today and tomorrow at the hands of the same killers robed in stately office. Well, that's the situation today in Canada, in America, or anywhere else in the so-called civilized world here in the year 2019. The same is true in Judea in the year 4 BC. The crime and the choice continue. In a way, that's all there is to say today. What matters is not what we say, but what we do. All the words spoken over the years, all the long interviews and tomes written about child sacrificial killings and genocide by church and state and baby trafficking, none of those words have stopped the killer's knives. The crime continues today unabated. And the only way it's ever going to stop is when we place our own bodies between those innocent victims and the killers who are coming for them. This sermon, like my life, is dedicated to that purpose, to stop them. Well, today it's obscenely ironic that the Christian churches that have spilled the blood of so many children will be presenting the gospel reading on the forthcoming Sunday in Advent, December 22nd. When you consider the enormous anger and denial among Canadian churchgoers, whenever we've tried speaking to them about their genocidal acts, you can bet that very few people in the pews in the Anglican, the Catholic, the United churches this Sunday, very few of them are going to draw a connection between Herod's slaughter of the innocent babies and his attempted slaughter of Jesus that they hear in the Bible, connecting that with their own murder of over 60,000 Aboriginal children over a century in the so-called residential schools. Because the Christians' once-a-week happy hour in church is not designed to place themselves in the Bible story or make it apply to their own lives. Well, despite all that, the blood of the innocent still cries out through the strongest cathedral church door and the most completely closed human heart. As the gospel passage today concludes, the mothers of the dead cannot be comforted. They cannot be comforted by all of the apologies by church and state killers, or all the reconciliation babble, or all the blood money payoffs, or all the fake government inquiries. because there's no moral statute of limitation on murder any more than there's a legal one. The guilt remains. The killers of children stand convicted and guilty and sentenced by the very fact of their crime, even if they be kings and rulers and popes. Well, that's the powerful message in today's gospel reading from Matthew. It's made doubly powerful by how closely it reflects how things actually operate in the world of politics then and now. For this is a story of the ritual killing of children, one of the oldest practices in history and a practice of church and state as common and as legal as war and genocide. The story goes, a group of so-called wise men, hired and dispatched by King Herod himself, search out a rumor that a baby is about to be born who's going to overthrow King Herod. There's kind of a dark humor that runs through this whole passage. Like any politician, Herod blithely cons the not-so-wise men into being his agents. He says, you know, I want to worship that newborn Messiah too. Please go find him. Well, the murderous intent is always surrounded in that religious garb, that self-righteous projection. Because isn't it a fact that people, and especially rulers, can more easily kill and order killing when they know that there's a God who sanctions and forgives them for all their deeds? And so, like obtuse academics or unwitting spies on a black ops mission, the Brett boys go to work for the killer on a throne. They eventually discover the little threat called Jesus in a manger, and they dutifully inform the king. Well, are these guys naive? Are they just doing their job? Or are they just stupid? Either way, their news frightens Herod and makes him even more paranoid than he already is, like anyone with a lot to lose. He sees conspiracies everywhere. He distrusts his bright boys and he tries to have them arrested. Well, failing that, he then goes after baby Jesus, using the information so conveniently provided by his wise guys. But Jesus and his family have been tipped off and they skedaddle away to a safe house somewhere. Well, frustrated not once but twice, Herod has to save face, and so like any ruler feeling his power slipping from him, he commits crime. He orders mass murder. Every child in the area under 2 years old is killed. Well, this clumsy scattergun approach fails to hit Jesus, of course, and one can almost hear the gospel writer chuckling up the sleeve of his robe, despite all the bloodshed. Warning, exile, murder. The usual pattern of corporate damage control. And then, of course, comes the final stage, the great mourning of this ritual killing that can never find comfort, the cries that never stop in any heart that's still alive. That's how this gospel story concludes, with the reality of life. Nothing is healed, nothing is fixed, because it's carrying on. And the killers don't feel sorry at all. And that should be evident. Well, this gospel passage may end on that message of mourning, unending mourning and wailing. But when you look deeper, that's the biblical answer to official murder, to the ones who never worry about covering up their mess because they know it's all legal and they're going to get away with it, like they always do. The Bible says, sure, go ahead. Worldly rulers can get away with anything, even the ritual satanic slaughter of children. Just look around the world, people. It's the norm. In the Mormon Church, in the Roman Catholic Church, all the major religions do it. That's been documented. We know that now for a fact. Just look at murderbydecree.com. Okay, that may be the fact of the world, but the survivors are a threat to all of that. The ones who survive with the memory and the knowledge of what these bastard criminals are doing, they're the answer. Because they can remember the crime and the fallen ones. That's a great power because they can keep the truth and the memory alive. The memory of those children are kept alive by the survivors, but only if they keep on shouting out the truth loudly and publicly, not going into counseling and feeling better about yourself and staying quiet or giving a gag order after giving a bit of money from the killers. No, that's not what we're to do. We're to keep shouting out the crime loudly. That's the only way we pay homage to the fallen and honor them. It's the only way this thing is ever going to stop, by letting God's own pain and outrage yell through our mouths. The wrong that's carrying on today, and that shout against the wrong carries on forever. That's the nature of God. It doesn't back off with the truth, like we're always pressured to do. Well, isn't it amazing how even at his birth, Jesus caused hysteria among rulers and poses such a threat to established authority. Our innocence and honesty always evokes that kind of reaction in the guilty and causes them to come down on us. Like any truth teller, Jesus became a refugee from state terror from day one and a wanderer in poverty and exile. And he stayed that way to the day of his judicial murder on a cross. So it's no accident that Jesus has always been a symbol and a great inspiration to the poor and the oppressed everywhere, for his life and death as the permanent outsider mirrors their own experience of the world. Well, middle-class churchgoers are another matter. They can't relate to the man, Jesus, except as an abstract cult figure. They tend to be left cold by the human Jesus and by any equating of him with rebellion against the established order or with the underclass, even though scripture is full of that association of him and the poor, and the struggle to overturn existing society. Well, as a clergyman, I constantly experience this dichotomy between how the poor view Jesus and how the affluent do. Take Jesus' first message when he gets up in Luke 4, they describe this, when he gets up in his hometown synagogue in Nazareth and proclaims that he's come to set the captives free, to raise up the poor and to open the prison doors and let everyone free. Well, that passage has always tended to alarm and confuse my wealthier parishioners. It genuinely confused them, said, like, what is this anarchist trying to do, right? But it brought, the same passage brought a relief of smile and amusement among poor folks, among Indians, among the other outcasts in the pews. This divide in the response of rich and poor became even greater when Jesus concludes his proclamation by announcing that he's inaugurating something called the Jubilee Year, that Hebrew tribal event that was really a social revolution. It's when all the debts were canceled, all the land and wealth returned to people, shared equally. It was that leveling down of society, the Jubilee Year. Well, Jesus, in other words, has been causing upset and turning things upside down ever since the day of his birth, and we still see that in the churches today and in any of us who try to embody that radical message. Well, that fact in today's gospel message doesn't exactly fit the feel-good, festive, middle-class Christmas season, because it lays out the four turbulent realities that characterize Jesus' life and work, like a cycle of life and death, a warning of danger, an escape into exile, a massive killing of the innocent, and a mourning for those fallen. To understand that, we have to go deeper into those four actions in the story by understanding their word origin and meaning. Well, the first action is a warning issued by unseen protectors, often the only ones who do help us. You have to get away now or you'll be destroyed. That warning. Well, the Greek word for warning is kremazo, and that means to be admonished by God and given a new purpose and name. You're not just given a warning. You say, okay, here's some camouflage. Here's a new identity so you can escape. In other words, you're not only yanked to your feet all of a sudden, but you're garbed with a new identity to get you the hell out of there. How else can you operate in this kind of murderous and deceptive world? Second step, you flee into exile. The word is fuego. In Greek and Latin means to fly away. But there's more to it than that. The word also means you shun evil by departing from it. So in other words, this fleeing isn't an act of fear, but it's actually part of a positive step into an inner cleansing of separating ourselves from the evil around us that inevitably affects us. Going into exile from everything we know is our first spiritual act in order to reform ourselves according to a higher heavenly aim. Throughout our many myths and legends, it's like that. The hero leaves his home country and people to go into foreign lands in order to discover his true purpose and his true strength. Well, because of that, the boot always comes down. The empire strikes back. State terror then slays the innocent. Step three. In Matthew 2, verse 16, the Greek word for slay, as in slew the innocent, is anareo, and that means to steal and then exterminate. The way animals are grabbed, bound up, penned in a cage, and then ritually slaughtered. The same word is used to describe sacrificing an animal or a child. It's part of a massive blood ritual going back thousands of years, whereby people believe that they were purified by the killing of something that is totally pure and innocent. You find in the Hebrew word kadosh, it means two things all at the same time. It means to sanctify, to make holy, and to sacrifice. We make something holy by murdering it. And there you have it. Bingo, the source of the crime. For wired into the language and thought of Judeo-Christianity is the ancient tribal belief that one cannot truly worship God and be made pure without ritually murdering the best, the purest, and the most innocent among us. Why else were the firstborn children of the Canaanites bound and thrown into the fire pit of their rapacious god Moloch, the fire god who ate children? Why was God's own firstborn son Jesus sacrificed on a cross? And why today is the death of the firstborn children of Ninth Circle cult members in the Mormon and Catholic churches the ticket of admission into the higher circles of those organizations? For all the same reason, innocent blood is still believed to be our key to worldly power and even ultimate paradise in heaven. Beyond sick. But what can one can do in the face of this murderous infamy? This monstrous crime, what can one do in the face of it but wail and mourn without end? And wailing isn't just complaining, it's shouting out a message. This kind of unending lamentation follows from the crime that we talk about today. In verse 18 in the passage today, the word for lament is threnos. The word in Greek, threnos, which means to cry out forever. It doesn't stop. But it also means, there's a double meaning again, it also means to warn, trouble, and frighten. As the mothers of the slain children who cannot be comforted cry out in their agony, they're also issuing a warning to the world, one that troubles and frightens people, as it must. For what else than that can rouse a compliant, a complicit population who are party to these crimes? What else can arouse them from that to do more than simply feel sorry for the victims? The gospel message today, and like so much of the gospel, is not meant to be politely listened to and then go away unmoved. It has to cause an eruption in the listener for change to work. There has to be an inner turmoil that breaks us free from the chains of evil and slavery forged on us since birth. Without that inner explosion, our hearts and lives will continue to be unmoved by the mass murder of children and will continue to refuse to stop the killers. And so now, each of you have a choice to make. You too have been warned to flee from such an association with death. You must accept a new name and purpose and go into exile from your life, from all that you have known, if you are to be made fit to bear witness to the crime and to give voice to the grief and to the fallen children. All of this is for a higher purpose, to make you fit to be the means of God's revolution by which the blood-soaked rulers and their evil prince of darkness are destroyed forever as the new creation dawns. As Jesus says later in the Gospel of Matthew, that which you refuse to do for me, you're refusing to all of my children, and that which you do to the least of my children, you also do to me. Well, may the great mystery lead you from this land of lies and murder and remake you in your own exile to be fit for the coming world. And for the least of these, our suffering children, their cries continue to reach out to you. Amen. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. More to come.
And we're back. Well, that's why I never liked the word healing. You know, I've done countless of these circles where survivors get together and they talk about their pain over and over and over and over. And you know, the state that did the crime, the churches, introduced this word among them called healing. And, you know, the reality is that you don't recover. You can maybe go on to a different place, and that's the whole idea. And maybe that's the word that sums up the message for today, flee. Flee the system of official murder and lies into something else. Don't heal. Heal means going back to the way you were before, and that's not possible. We want to transform. But to transform, you've got to be turned inside out. And that means embracing your pain, embracing everything you've learned, and build on it. I mean, I know that from my own life. I thought years ago this stuff should have destroyed me, losing my family, stability. You know, right now under a blacklist, which continues year after year, I remember somebody said, Kev, how come the New York Times didn't call you right away when that grave opened in Kamloops? And I said, well, because I'm the last person they want to call because I'll blow the latest spin out of the water. You know, you've got to permanently bury the evidence and the truth tellers. Okay, so they're able to do that effectively now, very effectively with the technology and the internet. You know, you check on YouTube and about 90% of the things we posted on there are now obliterated. They're gone. You put in the name Kevin Annett and bloody Justin Trudeau's film shows up in his image, right? I mean, there's an obliteration of all the evidence and information going on, but it doesn't change anything. It means we've got to flee from this lie all the more, all the quicker. And so we're not into healing, we're into transformation. And, you know, that's something that can only happen when you have knowledge. You know, you can talk about healing and forgiveness and all that. All that follows as a consequence of being truthful and mourning from your gut and remembering the real story. All of that happens. And that's what I'm going to end on this for the next 15 minutes or so. Go to murderbydecree.com. You can see it online. Don't have to pay a dime, or you can get the book for $20 from yours truly. Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, the answer to their official whitewash. Go to page 119, and there's a section here called Fashioning the Deceptive Narrative and the Language of Normative Genocide. And I wanted two very telling quotes. One of them is from Rudolf Hess, who is the SS commandant at Auschwitz at his trial in 1945. The other is from Brian Thorpe, who helped fire me, by the way, secretary of the British Columbia Conference of the United Church in 1996. And they're both saying the same thing. Here's Rudolf Hess. The so-called ill treatment and torture story in our camp, stories of which were spread everywhere by people, were not, as some assumed, inflicted methodically, but were excesses committed by individual prison guards. Brian Thorpe. The abuses done to students at our Indian residential schools were almost benign in nature and generally random. They were not the result of a deliberate policy, but rather the isolated acts of certain individuals. Well, that's what genocidal perpetrators do as part of the normalization of genocide, saying, like, there's just a few bad apples. You still get that in any academic talk of residential schools. Yeah, you know, it was a bad chapter in our history. Otherwise, things were fine. It was just kind of a momentary glitch. Well, institutionalized criminality like genocide in the Western world is rarely, if ever, considered a crime by the people who do it because they see their system as benign and necessary, and they rationalize their involvement in it with a special language. And that language is designed to legitimate and normalize the system of murder. Missionaries save the savages who are civilized or assimilated rather than exterminated. Death camps inmates are relocated or processed. Enemy soldiers are pacified, not killed. Victims of genocide are abused. Every system of oppression requires such a doublethink language and an accompanying deceptive narrative to justify itself and to ensure the continued loyalty of its members. Nowhere was this more true than in the European effort to subordinate the world to its Christendom or its universal Christian empire, by which all of humanity had to come under the rule of the Roman papacy or die. The Canadian genocide was one expression of that imperial purpose and was designed from the beginning as an essentially religious enterprise. I'm going to skip down a bit. Now, the remarkable aspect of the language of normative genocide is the double meaning within its words. And I want to look at three of those words: abuse, reconciliation, and apology. Well, abuse, of course, it was deliberately brought in 1990 when Phil Fontaine, the Papa Native leader, talked about his abuse in a residential school. Now, that word, of course, abuse, can mean anything from using harsh language to abusing a relationship, right? It's designed to muddy the waters to make it unclear. In reality, it was murder, but they call it abuse, right? Just like the word reconciliation. Look at the origin of the word. The reconcilia was a Roman practice whereby when a native tribal chieftain rebelled, he would be brought in after being captured, the rebellion put down. He would be brought to the Roman Forum, made to kneel in front of the emperor and be reconciled to the emperor and then ritually strangled to death. So reconciliation actually means to resubordinate yourself before a ruler. And apology, look it up in the dictionary. Oxford Dictionary says apology has nothing to do with being sorry. An apology is a justification of one's actions or writings, like an apologetic in English literature was, you know, you would defend the writings of another person. So apology actually means to justify yourself, to make it right. It has nothing to do with, I'm sorry. So you see, the double meaning in these English words that are used as part of the genocidal language is designed to get everybody to think that black is white, that the murder of 60,000 children was simple abuse that can be compensated for with a bit of money and a gag order and a nice little day on September 30th where we get to have a break from work and sit at home and drink beer and think of all the nice little native children who we harm, but it's all being made better now. So the use of this meaningless word abuse was deliberate as part of the government's legal strategy to contain the lawsuits that happened within tort law rather than criminal law. And this is, I noticed right at the beginning of this whole campaign back in 1995, the first lawsuit that I was part of was the first lawsuit ever brought in Canada against the church as a result of my actions. I found a document in the Kerner Library at UBC showing that the churches were made the legal guardian of the children in the residential schools by the government as far back as 1929. We put that into the court case of the first group of United Church survivors in Port Alberni to sue the church. And the judge, Judge Brenner, found the churches and government of Canada equally liable for what he called institutionalized crime because they were the legal guardian. So very soon after that, the whole issue legally was defined as an issue of abuse, which means it's in the same category as tort law, where you do damage to somebody. You take a brick and throw it through a window. You can be compensated for, and that's it. Mass murder of children is just a damage that can be compensated for. It's not under criminal law, where people go to jail and property is seized and institutions are disestablished. That's what happens when it's in criminal law, because a crime is a crime against everyone. A crime of murder is a crime against everyone. But the churches and the government and the courts, they all colluded to confine it as a tort law issue, not criminal law. And that defined the whole cover-up that followed. So that, again, is part of the normalization of genocide. And, you know, this is proven in practice so many times. And again, because it's being whitewashed so effectively, I really urge everyone to take the time. There's no 3-second, 3-minute answer to any of this. You've got to do some studying, some work, and it's all there online, murderbydecree.com, and write to me, angelfire101@protonmail.com. So, you know, I mean, it's there, the evidence is there. And the interesting thing too, and I want to end on this note, we've got about 5 minutes left, by redefining the whole term genocide. You know, genocide comes from two Greek words meaning to kill a people. And the guy who invented the term was called Raphael Lemkin. He did it at the United Nations right after the war. And his original definition said, genocide is whatever kills off a people. When you take children and separate them from their families, when you don't let them speak their language, it's equally as serious over the long run as putting them up against a wall and killing them. So he had three categories: physical, cultural, and medical genocide, sterilization laws, forced abortions. You know, all of it's considered as genocide. So what the United States and British and Canadian governments did, including Lester Pearson, this paragon of liberal Canadian society, they got on the committee and rewrote the definition of genocide in 1947. And because they actually said in letters that if we stayed to Lemkin's definition, we'd all be prosecuted for genocide, because as soon as you put a child in an Indian school and don't let him speak his language or see his family, that's genocide. Just like today, when you grab a child out of his home and put him in a vaccinated family home, that's genocide under international law. So they had to redefine it away from medical genocide and cultural genocide to a physical act. So now when you say genocide, everyone thinks, oh, you mean you kill people? No, that was only one of 5 definitions of genocide originally. So you see, by doing that, that's another tool of normalizing genocide. You just swab it out of the memory so that, well, genocide is what happened in Rwanda, right? Or in Serbia, but it didn't happen in Canada. We're just trying to help these poor little Indians. That's the whole, you know, confusion that is deliberately sown. And let me tell you, it's one of the reasons I'm banned from campuses. And that happened yet again this last week. There was an offer made that I come to the University of British Columbia and speak on a panel discussion. And just like my invitation to Oxford University and all the other academic places, it was withdrawn that offer after about a week, because anything I talk about on the campuses, especially at the University of BC, where I first found a lot of this archival evidence, it refutes the whole official narrative, which is that we didn't set out to kill anyone, and it stopped in 1989 when the last school closed, 1996. No, it didn't stop. It's carrying on today, and that's the reality of what we're talking about. It was deliberate genocide. It's inherent to our culture. It carries on today. That's what we're observing in the COVID police state. That's what we're observing at every level now, what we're talking about. So you've got to know the history to know the present. And that's kind of a sample run of what's in murderbydecree.com. You've got to get that book into the curriculum. And let me tell you, in closing, one of the things I'm doing now, working in many communities off the radar, setting up rural communities under the authority of the Republic of Kanata, our own schooling system, our own tax base, we're keeping taxes in the community, our own laws, assemblies, our own militia and police force. We're pulling out of the system and setting up the alternative system. One of the basic things we're doing is we're teaching our children, the next generation, the real story of what they're in. This blood-soaked regime called Canada and the world, we don't have to be part of anymore, but you start by teaching children the real story. So I want to remind people about that. Also, in closing, a couple of reminders, too, that these programs are all archived at bbsradio.com/herewestand. We've been doing it now for 6 years, ever since the Republic was proclaimed in January 2015. We are using this program as an active tool of building the Republic. We have citizenship training schools, leadership school that's coming up very soon. And I'm going to talk about that more next week on the show, where we're going to devote more of the show to talk about the details of how we're setting up the Republic. And the citizenship schools, and also the way that we get people on the ground so educated in the common law that they can just take action. There's our own law passed a year ago, outlawing COVID measures, making officials stand down, and of course the banishment order we talked about earlier, getting these genocidal churches off our land because the crime is continuing. They're still trafficking children. They still have blood on their hands. They do not have the right to exist, these institutions. So all of this is part of the same struggle, folks. Like I said, murderbydecree.com, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca. Do the education, take a step, because this thing is not going to happen without your help. And, you know, that's just the reality of life, that you have to, you know, in one of my books, it said, you cannot bring anything to light without something being burned. And what is being burned is our whole life. The things within us, I think it's almost like a sword that separates us from the evil in the world and causes us to flee from it, also strikes us first. It separates our own heart and our mind from what we once were into a new, risky, but truthful reality that we're building. The new world offered to us through this dark time. So, on that low note, I thank you for listening today. I hope you take it hard and act on it. I know you will. Those of you who are committed to this and all of your wonderful emails, thank you again. And the final song is one of my favorites. It's by Phil Oakes, a folk singer from the 60s who was murdered in 1975. And it's called The Ballad of the Carpenter, about our good buddy Jesus. And he was once called, one of the traditions in the Mideast, they're known as just souls. And there is a tradition that says in every generation, there's 36 just souls born. The reason God doesn't destroy humanity for its evil is because of those just souls who uphold the truth of God in their life, regardless of the cost. And that, in ending, I just want to use a quote in that from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German pastor who resisted Hitler, and he was killed just before the end of the war. He said just before he died, what we need now is not geniuses or clever tacticians, but plain and honest people who are willing to act whatever the risk and without counting the cost. Will our inward power of resistance be strong enough, our honesty with ourselves remorseless enough for us to find our way back to ourselves? So remember that, folks, people who are willing to act whatever the risk and without counting the cost. Those are the ones who will lead the struggle. I hope we've contributed to that today. Follow our work Again, republicofcanada.ca, murderbydecree.com, live, learn, struggle. Write to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com, or me personally, angelfire101 at protonmail.com. Here's our brother Phil Oakes and our brother Jesus. Carry it on, folks. I love you tons. Stay strong, stay clear.